So are we gonna recall?
Okay, yeah, we're gonna start. I'm gonna call three people. The first one is, we asked people to put their name down, and some people started writing a question. This is such a great opening question. It's from Wynn. Is Wynn here? And it was, how do you feel? But you can get up and start. But then behind Wynn is Ace and Katie Turner.
Great.
How do you feel about oil drilling in Weld County?
How do I feel about oil drilling in Weld County?
Weld County.
In Weld County.
The fracking.
The fracking.
Thank you. Well, I think that Weld County has tended to be much more welcoming of oil and gas than a lot of counties around the state of Colorado. And I think in general, we've tried to strike a pretty good balance in Colorado between protecting the places that really need to be protected, like the Thompson Divide, which I've been fighting for more than 6 years now outside of Carbondale to make sure that those oil and gas leases can't be developed. And a place like Weld County that's a lot more comfortable in general with oil and gas. With fracking, so that you don't think I'm running away from that question.
No, not.
I'm not sure there's everybody here will agree with my position. I'm sure there will be some that will not. Is that I believe when done properly, with the proper casings and with the proper attention to our air and our water, that it can be done safely. Which is not to say that we shouldn't migrate to the cleanest energy possible. I believe that we should. We're going to have a transition period along here, but so that's where I am on that. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Katie, are you? You come on your way up, but Ace has written his question, so I'll ask that first when you come up and hang out. Ace asks, are you going to do an ad campaign to discourage opioid use?
This is, no, that's okay. That's you?
Okay.
I want to thank you for coming, Senator.
Well, you're not supposed to ask the question.
This was a glitch.
All right, so we're only supposed to have names, not questions. Okay. Nobody thinks we're screening questions. So here, let's do this. Why don't we call the names and then you ask your question?
Come on up.
So what's your, and you can just do it from there. Do we need to use the microphone? Just do it from there.
Yeah, Ace is fine.
Go ahead, Ace.
Yeah, so the question I had, and thanks for coming up here, Senator. I really appreciate you taking the time out of here.
It's not exactly a hardship.
But the opiate epidemic, I've been reading about it, and it's actually in this community a little bit, and I think there was a pretty big story in papers recently. And I know I grew up in the era of like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and also there was a huge campaign against methamphetamine use with billboards and stuff like that. But I was just wondering if Congress is looking at doing that type of massive ad campaign.
We have talked about it, and we've been passing bills to try to, none of which I think go far enough to try to begin to address the opioid, which is really two epidemics that are combining one. One is the prescription drug epidemic that we had to opioids, and the cheap black tar heroin that we now have, which is actually cheaper than opioids. I believe we should have a national campaign. I'm for that. I think we've seen that's reduced other drug use across time, but obviously we need much more than that here. We need to have addiction treatment around the country. We need to make sure that we're diminishing the amount of these drugs that are being prescribed to begin with, in my view. And we need to work with Mexico to do everything we can to try to disrupt that heroin trade. It's not just happening here, it's happening all over the state. And there are places that I've been now for over and over and over again for the last 8 years, where I'll go and there'll now be four questions on opioids, or four statements on opioids. Mostly people saying, we don't remotely have the facilities we need to deal with this. You go to very, very conservative places on the eastern plains of Colorado, and the sheriff, and I visited jails out there, and the sheriff will say, my jail is full, our overflow is going to the next county over, I've got women in my jail for the first time, I wouldn't have ever said that, he's saying that. And there's people that are addicted to opioids, and they're not getting better in jail. So I think this crisis is threatening to overwhelm communities in Colorado and in the country, and it's one of the reasons why it was so critical for us in the Senate to fight back the cut that was proposed, 25% cut of Medicaid, that was proposed as part of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. That would have hit rural communities and rural hospitals the hardest, and in many places, it is the only resource available for addiction treatment. It's not enough, in my view, but at least it's there. And that was one of the reasons why the Republicans had such a tough time in the end with that bill, because rural counties across America were saying, you're cutting off our nose to spite our face. If that's a saying, I think it is.
Still.
So this actually kind of ties into what he said. I recently graduated from nursing school, and I'm now a psychiatric nurse in Grand Junction. The inpatient mental health facility there is the only one between Denver and Salt Lake. So we get patients from all four states that border us. What specifically are you working on, or would you like to work on, to increase mental health awareness and funding besides the overall health care bill?
Well, besides the overall health care bill, I guess I'd just say that we need much more primary care treatment in this country, including mental health and including addiction services. And I just came from a community where they basically built a new nursing home in part because the nursing home was being used to detox people that had no other place to go. You know, these are the kinds of decisions that reflect a society that's not thinking intentionally about where we need to be. So I think more investment on the front end is probably better. Thanks.
Ruthie, your name is up and you're loud enough that you can
vote. Thank you, Senator Bennett, for being here.
Thank you.
Always great to see you. Do you support the Climate Leadership Committee's proposal for a carbon fee and dividend and putting a price on carbon?
I do think we should put a price on carbon, but I think there's a lot, I don't think anything like that's going to happen in the near term, because we have an EPA director who doesn't believe that climate change is real. We have a head of the Department of Interior who doesn't believe that climate change is real. And we have a president who did the one thing that I thought, the promise I thought he would break, he actually kept, which was his promise to take us out of the Paris Accord. That's incredibly damaging to the leadership of the United States. We now find ourselves in the company of Syria and Nicaragua when it comes to global leadership on climate. And what I hope we do over the next however long President Trump is in office is follow the lead of what Aspen is doing and what other communities are doing around the country, which is to build toward a carbon-free future. And someday we may have a rational bipartisan agreement that allows us to price carbon. From a Republican point of view, it actually makes a lot of sense. I'm talking about now our grandfather's Republicans, not the existing Freedom Caucus in Washington, D.C. But if you could come to an agreement where you were actually reducing taxes on income and increasing taxes on consumption, particularly consumption of something we want to consume less of, in this case carbon, that's actually a pretty traditional conservative view of the world, and George Shultz and others have put that forward. So thank you for the question.
Good answer.
Not actually here to provide editorial content, but I'll take it.
It may slip out. Chris Coulon, am I pronouncing it right?
Hi, my question is about the media and also, but mainly I'm kind of worried about like Sinclair Broadcasting and how this propaganda television seems like it's going to be infiltrating our state, every state around us, and it seems like they're doing a bit, maybe proposing to let them have more percentage of the airwaves. And I wondered how that affects us.
Can you guys hear that question?
No.
Sort of about the media generally, that's how I'm gonna treat it. And also worries about Sinclair Broadcasting buying into our state and being allowed to, and I won't pass on the transaction because I haven't looked at it yet, but I will take the opportunity to tell you what I am talking every single time I have the opportunity to with middle school students and high school students. Can you hear me? Do you have any trouble hearing me? Try to speak up a little bit. With middle school students and high school students, because they come to my office in Washington or I see them here, and we have a conversation about lots of things, but one of the things I say to them is, have you heard any of this discussion about fake news? And they all say, yeah, we've heard about that. And I said, let me ask you, talk to you about that a little bit, because you guys have to write school papers, right? And they say, yeah, we do. Or if they say, no, we don't, then that creates a whole other discussion where they're going to school and what's happening there. But in general, they say, yeah, we have to write papers. And I say, well, you do your research on the internet. And they say, yeah, we do. And don't you have to distinguish between what is edited content, what is curated content in a way, versus just somebody shooting their mouth off on the internet? And they say, of course we do. If we don't do that, our teachers will fail us. And what I then point out to them is, that's no longer a standard we're holding our politicians to. The same standard that we're holding middle school students and high school students in this country to. And we have a president now who every day tries in one way or another to disqualify the free press and edited content. In fact, he seems to prefer unedited content, someone shooting their mouth off on the internet, to edited content. And it's not to say the press isn't infallible, they make lots of mistakes, but they are critical to our functioning as a democracy. And for the first time in our history, we see an attempt from the White House to disqualify them from the debate, and therefore science, and therefore lots of other things. And so I think your question's so important, because I think the democracy and the republic's only going to be as good as the press that's covering it. And if you're somebody who feels like maybe you can't withstand the scrutiny for some reason, and so what you're going to do instead is attack, 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 we're going to have a problem, I think, as a country. A shorthand way of answering your question without answering on the specifics of the transaction is that it's my belief, I could be completely wrong about this, but I believe it in my bones, that if Walter Cronkite is reading us the news at night, there's no way President Trump survives the Republican primary, much less becomes President of the United States of America. And now when we have decisions in front of us like North Korea and Iran, and you begin to see why this actually isn't a game that we're playing, and why it's so important that we do have a robust free media in our country. I was in Mexico recently, and 200 journalists have been killed there because they've been reporting on corruption at local levels of government, and there's not been a single investigation that's been conducted of any of these journalists. Think about how weak the institutions are down there because there isn't the ability of a free press to call the question. So I'm glad you raised it. It often isn't raised in these conversations, but I do think this is at the core of what's at stake in this particular political moment of the country's history.
Jane Carey?
Yes.
By the way, I was serious about what I said about all the reporters in the back. It was great to see that, because when you go to newsrooms all over America now, there aren't people to do the reporting anymore. There are folks that can go on, do the internet stuff or go on TV, but to actually do a deep dive into what's happening to this city's water infrastructure, what's happening, you know, in Syria, it's getting harder and harder for the American press to do that. Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, these are all important, thoughtful questions, but the crux of it is, how do we get campaign reform to get the people back into government, to get rid of Citizens United, to get term limits, to get election campaign limits, money limits, so that everybody has a voice and our legacy is giving our children and grandchildren a voice, because we've lost it.
So I believe strongly that we have to fix this problem. I was on a Ezra Klein podcast the other day, and he asked me, is it corrupt? Is the system corrupt? And I said, yeah, it is corrupt, which apparently was unusual for somebody in the Senate to say, but I believe it, so I said it. And I said, but one of the things that you need to understand about it is that the Supreme Court totally misunderstood what it was dealing with when it decided Citizens United. And with respect to my middle school friends that I meet with, I used to go around the state saying that when I read the majority opinion in Citizens United, it was like reading a seventh grader's paper about American government and the way it works. And now I don't say that anymore, because I think it's insulting to seventh graders to say it. But what this court missed, and what has totally infected our politics, is they said, okay, we're dealing with restraints on giving to campaigns. And because we've defined giving to campaigns as political speech, then we're dealing with the restraint of speech. Is that constitutional? And they said, well, first of all, we're dealing with quid pro quo corruption, which is the idea that you give me $5,000 and I go write a bill that you like. That's quid pro quo corruption. And they said, well, we punish that already. We have that's corrupt anyway, so we can punish that. So what we must be dealing with is the appearance of corruption. And does you giving me $5,000 and my writing a bill that's consistent with your views, even though I didn't do it because you gave me the money, rise to a level that can concern us enough, in this case, to erode the First Amendment rights of billionaires to give tens of millions of dollars or whatever they want to super PACs, which is ultimately what they decided. And what they completely missed in the analysis is that it's not about the appearance of corruption. It is, as you point out, about corruption. But it's not a corruption of action where you give me $5,000 and I then write a bill. It's a corruption of inaction. You want to know why this Congress can't get anything done? It's because of this. And it's not because you give me $5,000. It's because a senator who wants to say that climate change is real, and go against their party to say that, knows that if they say it, there's a billionaire somewhere who can write a $30 million check into their election, the next election, and that's protected speech by the First Amendment. So they have, and the court had earlier said, as I mentioned, they described speech as, or donations to campaigns as speech. Money is speech, is what they said exactly in a case called Buckley against Vallejo in the early 70s. And in this case, what they said in Citizens United, what they said was, in a democracy, you can not have enough speech, never enough speech. Corollary to that, if money is speech, is that in a democracy, you can never have enough money. And I have yet to meet a single person in Colorado who thinks the problem with our political system is that there's not enough money. Not one. But that is the U.S. Supreme Court's position. And that is the position of Mitch McConnell, the leader of the majority in the Senate. So you ask, what are we going to do? We better send some people to Washington. They'll fix the system. At the local level, we need people that are willing to pass referenda and laws and statutes that say we're going to govern this for ourselves. And if you pay money for a political ad, you better put your name at the end of it so everybody can know who's there. I think we need to work for disclosure at every single level. I wish there were no money in our politics, but we have a long way to go to undo the damage that the Supreme Court has done. What, by the way, just the last point on this, one of the things they had to do to get to their result in that case was to change a precedent of the Supreme Court from like 9 years before. And they said one way you change a precedent is by, you know, when it's not a long period of time, because the court respects precedent, is if there's been what they called a changed fact and circumstance. And I think my constituents, many of them, would testify to the Supreme Court that there has been a huge changed fact and circumstance since they let these billionaires give whatever they want to these campaigns. Look at my friend Jeff Flake from Arizona, who wrote a book called Conscience of a Conservative, published it 2 weeks ago, saying, you know, Donald Trump has nothing to do with the Conservative Party I grew up in, and with the Barry Goldwater. And what's his reward for that? He's got a billionaire who supported Donald Trump writing $300,000 checks to support his primary opponent. That's not how the system should work. And to imagine that somehow all that money can flow in the system and not corrupt the system is such a suspension of disbelief that no high school kid in this place would ever believe it, rightly so.
Well, let's cheer people up. Okay. David, you had a question about Social Security.
Yeah, I had a question about health care specifically as well. I'm paying $1,600 a month for a family of four for our health insurance this year. We each have $7,000 deductibles, so that's about $50,000 out of pocket. We only had one plan, an individual plan, in this area in the state this year, and you know, everything in the press says that prices will go up. If they do,
I think that, first of all, that's very well said, and I think that you're making choices that nobody else in the industrialized world has to make about their health care. I mean, it's literally true. And we're also, as a country, spending too much. We're spending 16% of our GDP on health care, while every single industrialized world country in the world is spending roughly half that or even less than half that. What I think we need to do in the very short term, like I'm talking about days, not months, is stabilize the individual market in the United States. And part of doing that is to pass legislation that overcomes the president's threat that he's not going to release the subsidies that are that Congress put there to be able to at least ameliorate the cost of health insurance. But that's a very immediate issue. I think the fact that you have no competition to buy insurance is a huge problem. It's one of the reasons why I support a public option for people, and I have since the beginning of when we passed the Affordable Care Act to begin with. I think that was a huge missed piece of the puzzle to give people an option.
Don't you think the problem is that large employers are completely immune, and there's only 40 million of us paying in the individual market to subsidize the other 30 million that are too poor to pay the premiums? If you go work for a big company, you don't feel this pain.
Yeah, but the reason you don't feel that pain is that in a big company, you're part of a huge pool of people that cross-subsidize each other. You're not subsidized. You are it's actually a very interesting point. You are in a group of people that actually has driven the current political debate about health care, but it is only the 7% of the people that are insured in this country, which is cold comfort to you. My point, though, is that we should have been fixing that problem instead of saying this was a Bolshevik takeover of our healthcare system or a socialist takeover of healthcare, or whatever it is we said. You are not subsidizing people in big companies. They are raking you over the coals because they have no economic reason to give you insurance. And that's we have designed the system in a way that has this break. And what we had tried to do with the Affordable Care Act was to give you a subsidy if you were in the situation you are in, but I suspect the problem you have is that you probably make too much money to qualify for the subsidy and therefore don't get it. And you're in a place, as you said, where there's no competition for your business. It's the worst of all possible worlds. So as I work on the education committee with Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, who run that in the coming weeks and months, I'm happy to meet with you and to see what precisely we can do to help fix it, but it's going to be very, very difficult to fix. It's just being honest about it, and it's a fractured part of the way we deliver healthcare in America. The reason if you're in a big company, what they know is that they're going to have some sick people, they're going to have some healthy people. They know they're going to have some older people, they're going to have some young people, and they're able to pool the risk. In rural America, there are many fewer people. It's much harder to pool the risk. I'm not defending the insurance companies. I'm just explaining the economics. And in this part of the country in particular, so drawing a line from Frisco to Grand Junction to Aspen and north to Steamboat, the problem is that you've got medical providers here that are able to command very high prices because we have affluent neighborhoods. And those combinations intersect to make your insurance among the most expensive of anybody on the planet. And, you know, I think you should be able, as I said earlier, I think you should be able, maybe I didn't say it, but I said to the reporter, I think you should be able to buy into public insurance if you want. I think you should be able to pool with a broad range of people around the country if you want. I think you should be able to get the same coverage that the Congress gets if you want. And you can pay for it. All of that's going to be hard to do when we're fighting a group of people who think that socializing the risk is the same thing as socialism. It's not the same thing. And that's what insurance does. It socializes the risk. And you don't, just as you don't know when your family's going to be sick, and so you do the responsible thing by buying health insurance, other folks should be doing the responsible thing as well. And we have a long, long way to go here. So I'm sorry not to be able to give you a more comforting answer than that, but that's sort of where we are.
All right, Dick Durance, are you here?
Yeah.
The other thing, by the way, this won't help your insurance problem. Another thing we could do is have Medicare be able to negotiate drug prices on behalf of the American people, which would
of Korea, the rhetoric bounces off the walls. Is there any kind of safety latch on that button?
No. We have oversight, and there are legal, but we're committed to the rule of law, or at least I am, and he's been elected President of the United States. I think what we need to do is we should conduct hearings in Washington about the North Korea situation. I think anybody who's got any influence over the president should be explaining to him that that the way he's behaving, first of all, anybody, I'm telling you, there isn't a Republican that I'm aware of in the Senate who believes that he should be tweeting his way through his foreign policy. Not a single one. And mentioned earlier, we've sort of fallen completely away from Teddy Roosevelt's view of the world that, you speak softly and you carry a big stick. And that's a way not only of avoiding trouble, but of knowing that people understand that when it needs to be done, force is something that's available to us. What you worry about in a situation like the one he's creating is that he overcommits the United States and forces us to take an action that we might well not have had to take. Instead, what we should be doing is working with our allies and working with China and others to try to put as much pressure on North Korea as we can. This is not an unserious, obviously, this is a, let me not even say it that way, it sounds unserious. This is a serious problem that confronts the world community and confronts the United States as the leader of the world community, and I still believe we are the leader of the world community, and we need to make sure that anybody that has an influence does, and that the leaders of our Defense Department and our State Department and others are hearing more measured voices in Washington. And I hope to be one of those.
Dana, where are you, Dana?
Oh, and you didn't ask this question, but I'm going to add. In the wake of all this North Korea stuff, the president's also talking about walking away from the Iran deal that President Obama signed.
Oh, geez.
Can you imagine if we were in a world where you now had not just North Korea building a bomb in secret, but Iran building a bomb in secret at the same time? How could that possibly help us? So, anyway, there's more even. Yes.
I want to ask you about the increasing costs of pharmaceuticals in the country. I'm a physician, and my patients frequently cannot afford the drugs that I prescribe. I see it as a twofold problem. Number one, the FDA makes it incredibly expensive for companies to develop drugs. I think an average cost to develop new drugs is about $2 billion. So the drug companies do have some rationale in passing some of that cost on. But the other thing that really I find appalling is the ads on television. Mm-hmm. You can't turn on a channel on TV without seeing an ad for a prescription drug that rarely does somebody really need. And the last way you should approach it is to have the person ask the doctor if they should have a drug. It should be the doctor telling patients, not the other way around. So what is the Senate and Congress doing to put any limits on the pharmaceutical industry?
So let me first say how happy I am to have a medical doctor to ask this question to, which is, one of those ads about that purple pill has the two people sitting in ceramic bathtubs about 6 feet from each other. And I've always wondered, doesn't that get in the way of whatever that pill is supposed to be? That's what I think about it every time I see that.
That's the blue pill.
Oh, that's the blue, I'm sorry. That's what I had wrong to begin with. It's terrible. So let me talk briefly about your first point, because it seldom comes up, but I totally believe it. I mean, the FDA has a responsibility to make sure stuff is safe and effective, but safe. But it isn't really their job to make sure that the United States has a thriving bioscience community. And I think it's really important for the United States to have a thriving bioscience community, because that's where some of the greatest innovation comes from, that's where a lot of life-saving therapies are going to come from, and in our state, in a lot of states, that's where a lot of people are getting paid a lot of money. I mean, if you're worried about incomes going down, that's a place where there's innovation, there's incomes going up, and we have leadership. And it's one of the reasons why I worked with a guy named Richard Burr, who's a Republican from North Carolina, to write a bill called Breakthrough Therapies, because I had heard from our Colorado Biosciences Committee that what you had been saying, it was creating such a problem, the FDA backlog was creating such a problem that people couldn't raise venture capital in the United States anymore. It was going to Europe and going to Asia because of the regulatory uncertainty of the FDA. And they said, can you help? And so we did, and we wrote this new thing called Breakthrough Therapies, working with the Friends of Cancer who are deeply interested in the bill. And we thought one drug a year would be approved. And in the last 5 years, I think, we've had over 60 drugs that have been approved, lung cancer drugs, cystic fibrosis drugs, leukemia drugs, that have made a lot of difference to a lot of patients around the country and made a lot of big difference to our bioscience folks. Some are small and some are big, who have been able to raise venture capital more. I don't want to overstate the benefit, though, because we haven't done anything about drug prices. So if you've got a great leukemia drug but you can't afford it, it's not really going to mean much to you, or you have to bankrupt your family. I think the central, there are two pieces to this, I think. One is specifically related to drugs, one to medicine. The one to drugs is, I mentioned earlier, which is I believe Medicare should be able to negotiate drug prices. And the VA negotiates drug prices. There's no reason why Medicare can't do it, and we should do it, and that would reduce the cost of drugs, and I think also have the benefit of pushing people away from name brands and toward generics. I don't know enough about the advertising, except that how much I hate it to say anything smart about that. But what the final point I would make is, and you're in a position to reject this view because you know better, but my sense of healthcare now, having studied it the last 9 years, is that it is a place unlike almost any other place in America in our economy that we have tolerated opacity as a business model. And it is absolutely impossible for the consumer to know what anything actually costs and why it costs what it costs. And that's true from doctor to doctor, it's true from pill to pill, it's true from hospital to hospital. If you want to read something on this, Steve Brill wrote a cover story 3 years ago on the front, it was on the cover of Time magazine, about what's called the charge master, which are these things that hospitals use, they're like this thick, to determine what you pay them. And it has literally nothing to do with the cost of whatever it is they provided. And that's a recipe for a system that's not going to be cheap, and it's a recipe for a system that's not going to be efficient, and it's not going to drive the kind of results I think that we need. So transparency, I think, is also important in all aspects of medicine, not just drugs, but drugs is a big part of that. If you look at Medicare Part D, well, I'll stop.
I thought the audience.
A lot of colleagues, I'm an eye surgeon, we are way behind the rest of the world when it comes to lens implants, as an example. So if you go to Australia to an international meeting, we see so much technology that we're not allowed to use in the United States. We're like 5 to 10 years behind the rest of the country because of the FDA restricting our access to newer technology that's available abroad.
Okay, well, that's something I'd like to learn a lot more about. So let's connect after that.
Okay. I thought the audience was going to go on and on, but this guy's going on.
Sorry.
Richard Stevens.
Hi.
Thank you, Senator, for
coming
here. My question is about immigration reform and the process for illegal aliens that are here. There's a pardon and a waiver process. My son-in-law, daughter-in-law, just went through a year's worth of paperwork with Homeland Security and Immigrations to get this process done. They were approved. They have documents. I have a copy of it. They were instructed last week to go to Juarez. The agent down there denied the approval, and now they're stuck in Mexico.
Give me that stuff.
And
it's
ripped my family apart.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Is this a copy that I can
Yes, sir. I was going to mail this to you. But
here's the waiver that we approved.
Okay.
And here's the document that the agent said they're not going to approve
all
it
copies.
After.
I just don't want to lose the.
They feel they were entrapped by our government.
And now they're in Juarez.
And now they're in Mexico and can't get out.
I don't know where Julie is.
They're farmers and ranchers, and they live here in Newcastle.
Yep.
And they have property that needs attention.
Yep. Okay.
They need to be back here.
Before you leave, that's John Davidson, my chief of staff. So before we leave, let's make sure we get together. I have people in my office whose full-time job is trying to solve these issues. And I promise we will try to solve it. I don't know whether we will succeed or not, but we will try. And just so everybody else knows, this is a daily thing in my office. And I just met last week with a woman named Gloria who has lived in the United States for 25 years. I met with her and her family in a trailer in Brighton, Colorado. She is has an animal husbandry degree from Mexico. Her husband has an animal husbandry degree from Mexico. She has like 70 letters from the local school district where she works in Brighton or in North Denver area. With them that day were their children in their trailer. One is a mechanical engineer, master's degree grad from the University of Colorado. The other is a special ed master's degree from the University of New Mexico. And if something doesn't happen between now and the middle of this month, she's going to be deported from the United States of America.
And they voluntarily went through the
process. I understand, but
got the waiver, got the pardon,
and that's my.
And then an agent down there.
And that's where I hope we might be able to try to help, because we're making this case too for kids that signed up onto the deferred action stuff, the so-called DACA things, who are now confronting the fact that they've given their information to the White House or to ICE, and now they may also lose their chance of being here. So I'm glad you came. I wish you'd called. Anybody who faces similar things, please call our office.
Well, this just happened.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're here. And I'm very glad you're here. And this is more important than anything else we've talked about today.
And they feel they were entrapped by our government.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think a lot of the kids from the DACA feel the same way. So thank you. Thanks for bringing.
I need your help.
We will do anything we can do. We will do that. So
George,
make sure you guys connect.
George Newman.
Hey, George.
Welcome to Picking County. We are welcome to County.
What? Say it again.
I said welcome to Picking County.
Thank you, Commissioner.
If you don't know, we are welcoming County.
Yeah.
So many questions. It's a little time.
Well, I'll stop talking.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming here for a town meeting. It's so rare now that we see a congressional delegate who's willing to hold a town meeting. The only time we see some of our other congressional delegates in Picking County is when they're at a private home with their hands out. So thank you. Yeah. Touch on a lot of different topics. Sort of on a bigger picture, though, as we're seeing more and more of a rift between the president and the Republican Party, is that helping you and the Democratic Party in terms of trying to work a little closer together or not?
I think that it will. I think, for instance, on health care now, we have an opportunity to do what we should have done from the beginning, which is work together to try to address it. My concern is we're not going to come close to addressing this gentleman's concern about his health insurance, which is exactly, like, if I had to pick one thing that I've heard that has been a, I've heard lots of nightmares, but it's in some ways arguably a consequence of the Affordable Care Act. It's not that the price has gone up because of the Affordable Care Act, but the Affordable Care Act did say you have to buy health insurance, and if you don't buy health insurance, you have to pay a penalty. And if you make a certain amount of money, you're not eligible for the subsidy. So if I say to somebody, you have to buy health insurance, and it's going to cost you an arm and a leg, and you're not going to, and you've got a deductible that's as high as the deductible he said, to me, it's a completely legitimate critique of the Affordable Care Act, not of health care, not of the Affordable Care Act, to say, why are you forcing me to buy something that is useless to my family and then penalizing me for it? And when I said on the floor over and over again that the reason, when I said on the floor that the bill that the people that wanted to repeal Obamacare was completely unresponsive to the critics of Obamacare who had the biggest beef, it's exactly for that reason. Because it did nothing to solve it. In fact, it only made matters worse because it reduced the subsidy and drew the line to other places. So now I do think on healthcare we're going to have the opportunity to do it. The question is, can we go far enough to make a difference, and or to create an opportunity for states to make more of a difference, or local communities to make more of a difference, to say, we're just going to do it in a different way. We're going to have a public option, or we're going to have a single payer, you know, whatever it is. On other things, I think it's still taking time for Republicans to say they're willing to step out from where the president is leading them. But every week that goes by, there's more and more opportunity to work with them on a bipartisan basis for the good of the country, and that's what I hope to see. I'm sorry it's taken the election of President Trump to force that. I think we should have been working together before this, but I do think there's an opportunity on the back end of this.
Doug Reinhart?
Yeah. I too would like to thank you for coming to the Royal Valley for...
I'll repeat it.
I'd like to thank you for coming here for a town hall meeting. I was kind of hoping you'd bring Cory Gardner with you. But he's probably licking his wounds after Durango. So. And I would also like to thank you for voting against the so-called Trump health care bill. Now, I would like to hear your justification for voting to confirm David Bernhardt as the number two man at the Interior Department.
Sure.
Here's a man who has spent basically his whole career as a lobbyist for the gas and oil industry and spent a hell of a lot of his time trying to circumvent the rules and regulations that were set in place by the government to protect the environment and protect our health. And in his confirmation, he said that policy decisions will be based on the administration's agenda. Well, we all know what that is. And how can that possibly help the environment and help our health? And you said in your reply to why you voted for him that you have confidence that he will protect our lands. And I'd like to know, where do you get that confidence?
Well, I appreciate the question. Thank you for it. The reason I voted for him is that he is from Rifle, Colorado. Let me finish the thought. He's from Rifle, Colorado. He is well aware of places not far from Rifle, Colorado, and not far from the Pitkin, and not far from the Roaring Fork Valley, that I've spent the last 8 years of my life fighting to protect, along with people in these communities. I think, in particular, the ranchers in certain parts of this area. We had extremely long conversations about that work in the course of the interviews that I had with him. And I cast my vote on the assurance that before he did anything to change any of those rules, he would listen to Colorado's farmers and ranchers and environmental community. I could turn out to have made a terrible mistake. That's always possible, but that is the reason why I voted for him.
Thank you. Judy Francis?
Most of my questions have been answered, but I've heard, and thank you for coming, met you before.
That's better than saying most of my questions have been asked but not answered.
And I was hoping you wouldn't call on me, because my question is, how the hell are we going to get rid of this guy?
Yes.
And myself.
The next one.
And probably the next one. DC is a reality show. It's such an embarrassment to our country and to people overseas that make fun of the guy in the White House.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, I think that in order to get to a place, and I take the question in the spirit we're all having this discussion, maybe it's wrong, but I think the honest answer there is we have, the founders set up a set of processes for us to go through to make a determination about whether somebody should continue to serve in the office, and the oversight that's going to be created, which, by the way, almost no other country has. I went to one recently, I mentioned it earlier today, where you have an independent prosecutor in the form of Bob Mueller, who I have confidence in, I think a lot of people do. You've got the House and the Senate doing oversight hearings that are working, I think, in general, pretty well in a bipartisan way, certainly in the Senate. Maybe I can't speak for the House on that. Because, in fact, let me say, I have more confidence in the Senate than I do in the House. on this, and we should provide our oversight, and we should take it where it leads us, always subscribing to the rule of law. This is another conversation that I've had with the middle school students and the high school students that I mentioned earlier, because they come to D.C. and they see the White House and the Supreme Court and all that stuff, and there's a tendency to take it for granted. I mean, this is one of the reasons I'm doing these meetings now, is that we shouldn't take it for granted at all. I mean, you know, if those guys who created, and they were guys who wrote the Constitution 230 years ago, were geniuses, and they were trying to create a mechanism to provide the chance for Americans to engage in self-government. And nobody had ever done it before, really. I mean, there's some historical arguments, but nobody had ever done it before. And they, when Ben Franklin got asked it one day when they were all there together, this is what I think about when I think about how screwed up this is all right now. They asked him, well, what kind of government are you creating, a republic or a monarchy? And his answer was, famously, a republic if you can keep it. Because he knew what they were writing down was only going to be as good as the generations that came after it. That it wasn't like a monarchy that would be inherited or an autocracy that would be inherited. It would be a republic if you could keep it. And honestly, none of these guys who wrote that stuff down would have thought we'd still be here 230 years later. If you read their papers, none of them did, because it was beyond comprehension to have even had a republic the size of the original 13 colonies, much less, and with the population of 13 colonies. Now we've got 330 million people, the strongest economy the world has ever known, the strongest defense, the opportunity for self-defense that the world has ever known. And now the question is as important as it was when Franklin mentioned it. And that's why I talked about the press earlier. And that's why we have to reinforce the independence of the judiciary, and why we have to enforce the separation of powers and make sure that we're sending people to Washington who seem to be actually working on the people's problems rather than each other's problems. And this is going to be a process, and it may come out the way you want it, it may not come out the way you want it, but I want to make sure on the back side of all this, we have the capacity to govern ourselves, and that we've kept the republic. And that's none of us signed up to do this, like you didn't and I didn't. Sign up to live in a time when you have somebody who seems to care as little as the president does about the separation of powers, or the freedom of the press, or the independence of the judiciary. But we shouldn't have to be working on that stuff. What we should be doing is working to solve that problem. Because every other country in the world has solved that problem. There's nobody else in the industrialized world who's standing up at a town hall. This is not an exaggeration. Who's standing up at a town hall meeting this afternoon, or yesterday afternoon, or tomorrow afternoon, saying, I am going to have to decide next year to go naked without insurance because of the way this system works. No one else in the world is having to make that choice, and we should have a government that can help address it, not solve every problem, but help. And in the meantime, unfortunately, I think we're going to have to be focused on a bunch of the things that you're talking about.
Our dictator.
Anyway, I've said my piece about that. What else?
Okay, we're almost out of time, but we could do one more question. Val Stevenson. Or we can do whatever.
Let's do. Do you have the stomach for five more, or do you want to?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do five more minutes. Now, as long as we got to go do something else. I'll share an ice cream at 10:30 this morning. Go ahead.
Mine is on immigration also. With the increase of deportation and the ICE agents coming in, taking a lot of the undocumented immigrants out of the country, and a lot of them have no criminal, we're seeing churches pop up for sanctuary, and now we're getting the threat in some cases from the president or from the administration, I guess Jeff Sessions, about cutting off funding to cities that do offer sanctuary.
Right.
And for me, in some ways, that's like a question of what government coming against a person's faith, because it is churches opening up. So I guess I wonder, in ways, what do you plan, or the government plans to do on fixing our immigration system, and also the issue of cutting off funding to cities that do.
So thank you. I'll try to be brief because I know the hour is late. I was part of the Gang of Eight, four Democrats and four Republicans, who wrote the immigration bill in the Senate 3 years ago. that created, among other things, a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million people that are here that are undocumented. It also had the most progressive Dream Act of any immigration bill that's ever been on the floor, much less passed the floor of the Senate. It also had money to secure our borders. It also had money and ideas to create internal security so small businesses in America didn't have to be the INS. And as I said earlier, there were eight of us that wrote the bill. And it would have taken us 4 months instead of 8 months, but at every session, it was like two or three sessions a week, we had to leave time for my Republican colleagues to talk about how much they hated Ted Cruz. And the advantage, he was, no, I'm serious, it was terrible. But they did, because they knew exactly what the base of the Republican Party would say about them being there. But they were there because they knew it was the right thing to do for the country and for their party, they thought. Now, I could never have predicted President Trump getting elected. In fact, I didn't predict it. And that's my failure. That's my failure. But I went all over Colorado saying to places, and I was running for office at the same time, saying to people, there's no way somebody this anti-immigrant is going to get elected president of the United States. And not only was I wrong about that, there were a lot of people who said, well, he'll change his tune once he's in the office. If you are not feeling the terror that people are feeling in Colorado around this, all you have to do is substitute your religion or your ethnicity or where your parents came from the stuff that he's talking about, and you'll feel it immediately. You will feel it immediately. And this is about families being ripped apart. This gentleman said it, and this is what's happening. And I said to Secretary Kelly, because before he was chief of staff, an old principal of mine in the Denver Public Schools had made a special trip to Washington to come see me to say, the kids at my school, Bruce Randolph School, are terrified because their parents are being deported. Can you come at least give them some comfort? Well, I said, I can come and tell them we care about them, which I did. I'm not sure it gives them comfort. And I said to Kelly, look, it does no good for America for kids in Bruce Randolph School to feel the way they do. Or for me to get calls, as I do, from mayors and county commissioners across the state who are telling me that we're losing witnesses in domestic abuse cases because people are so terrified to come to the courthouse because ICE is there to deport them. And if you don't believe that families are being ripped apart, then we just heard this in Aspen. Think about lots of places all over Colorado. The first people who signed up to work with me on almost the first, when I rewrote a set of principles for immigration in Colorado that predated the work on the Gang of Eight, were Colorado's farmers and ranchers. Because they know what the labor force issues here look like, and they know how we have worked with people from Mexico over many generations to do work that we'd rather do here in Colorado instead of having it migrate to Mexico. So I believe this is all totally a war, completely antithetical with who we are as a country, with our history, the commitment we've made both to our heritage as a nation of immigrants and to the rule of law. But in our time, it's people like this gentleman's family who are being split up. And I think one answer to this is people need to hear voices from other folks, that you want them here, that you're willing to put an arm on their shoulder and say, come to our church, and if you need to stay there, stay there. Which brings me to your second point, which is, I think Jeff Sessions should not be making federal money contingent on whether local police are willing to be immigration agents. So this is a really important set of issues now, and it really is a defining moment in the country's history. This hasn't been enough, by the way. The feeling, the chance that you've given enough people, the kind of feeling that they've been given in this country, isn't enough for this president. He now says he wants to cut legal immigration by 50% over the next 10 years, something that I'm sure New Zealand and Canada is incredibly excited about, but it's completely unclear to me why we should be excited about it.
Yes, real quick. I'm sorry, I have my granddaughter who's waiting for me. But I'm Patty Clapper. I'm a member of the Pima County Board of County Commissioners. Thank you for coming. Also, thank you for your recent introduction of the bill assisting local communities with leasing of Forest Service lands for appropriate and necessary uses.
Thank you.
If you need any of us to come testify to help support your bill,
we will call on you.
We're there. worked on it very hard to make sure we were following the letter of the law in the United States Constitution. A few days after we passed it, we were put on the naughty list. And I'm not kidding you, we were put on the ICE Homeland Security list of naughty communities for passing such a resolution. And for me, speaking for me, I'm very proud of that. My granddaughter is waiting, and come back anytime we would welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you for all your help.
Thank you.
No surprise that Patty's on a naughty list.
The bill she mentioned is a bill, the commissioner mentioned is a bill that, among other things, would allow us to work with local communities to try to create more affordable housing and more workforce housing by working more closely with the Forest Service. So that's what that's an effort to do.
Okay, we're going to bang through all three remaining comments that people followed the process and signed up for. Susan Hirsch.
First of all, it's astounding to hear a representative actually represent us, so thank you for your effort on our behalf and integrity. One of my questions, I'll be quick. What is your position, and what can you speak to the Democratic position, and how are you going to unify the party and reach out to the disenfranchised that got Trump elected? That's a quick question one. The other is it worth it, all the emails and calls I do to Cory Gardner? Is that voice ever heard or supposed to be heard?
Yeah.
And then the final question really quick is, what's it going to take? There's been so many flagrant illegal acts by the president and the people around him. What is it going to take?
Well, I think, look, it's there's three questions. I won't repeat a kind word that she said, but I will repeat three questions. One was, is it worth writing all these letters and emails she mentioned my colleague, but I'll undertake the question to me, to members of Congress generally. The first question was,
unifying
the Democratic Party and how do we rebuild after Donald Trump's election. And the third question was about
illegal
acts. So let me start with the third question. I'm not going to repeat what I said earlier, except to say we have a process. What's going to take is for us to have investigations, for those investigations to develop evidence, for there to be recommendations about whether cases should be opened or closed on people, whether. And all that, you know how all that works, so that'll either happen or it will happen. And then there are people that are going to have to make a decision that share my title, who are also members of the House, are going to have to make a decision whether these rise to a level that there should be hearings in the House and whether there ought to be hearings in the Senate. I don't want to front run any of that stuff. And it's just because I think the system ought to work and it should be given a chance to work. So, and I think it is working. The second point is absolutely, I know people that have been there for 30 years that have been heard more from their constituents than in their entire lifetime. Funny, I hadn't thought about this actually until this moment, and you can watch the tapes of other town halls that I did. I haven't said this to anybody, but I asked Daniel Inouye once, who had been in the Senate for a billion years when I got there. And I said, what's the biggest change from when you first got here until now? And this was before, years and years ago, he said this. He said, the biggest difference for me is I used to get a letter a day, maybe, from Hawaii. And now I get email all day. But it's nothing compared to what people are seeing now. And the social media presence, I know in my office, and also Corey's and others, has been amplified in ways that never happened before, and I think it is making a difference. I think people are showing that you need to be heard. And my own plea to those of you that know something about social media, which I don't know enough about, is to figure out how to make this something of a put this in the service of our republic, is what I was talking about earlier. And because sometimes I think it's too much of an echo chamber about what's gone on the cable television the night before, and they're not the same thing. The service of the public is different from that. It takes longer to figure out what direction we need to head. And I think that actually informs my thinking about your first question, which is, what do we do as for those of us that are Democrats? And I am deeply alarmed that whatever we did was not sufficient to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president of the United States. And it wasn't. And I think we do need to have a considered debate and discussion within our party about how to pursue a set of policies that actually are relevant to a broad swath of the American people, many people who feel like this economy that has actually grown in many ways from when President Obama became president, but hasn't grown enough for enough people in the country. And that shared economic growth, I think, is what people want to see. And my guess is on that, is speaking as one Democrat, not representing the caucus, is that it's less likely that ideas that we developed in the 1960s are going to help yield the result we want to see in the 21st century than some people believe. I mean, there's some people in the party who believe that's where we're going to find the answer. I don't agree with that. I'm less confident in the federal government's ability than some of these other folks are. And I am worried, you know, when you face 20 years of flat income in the United States for the middle class, which is basically what we've faced, and you've had rising health care, rising, by the way, 40 years ago, nobody would have asked the question that gentleman asked. Rising cost of healthcare, rising cost of housing, rising cost of higher education, rising cost of early childhood education, which 40 years ago nobody would have had to ask either because somebody would have been staying at home. We need answers to that as a party. And I think if we can develop those and develop a consensus around those, and people actually think we believe what we're saying, that we're authentic about what we're presenting, and that maybe we also are willing sometimes not to feel like we have to have a monopoly on wisdom, that other people will come our way. There's not a farmer in America, in my view, that shouldn't believe that climate change is real. Not a farmer in America that shouldn't believe it's real. But we should be asking ourselves sometimes, are our politics around that, politics that are inviting other folks to believe that that's real too? Or are we just expressing a point of view that is comfortable where we sit, but may not be comfortable where somebody else sits?
Howie Mallory.
Senator Bennett, thanks for coming up here.
Thanks.
My question is sort of on the lines that you were just talking about working with the Republican Party, bringing it home locally to Colorado. You and Senator Gardner represent the state, four corners of the state, and the citizens of the state. Do you ever meet with Senator Gardner to talk about issues that are common to the state, healthcare in particular, so that Colorado can deal with its healthcare problem, or your hands tied, his hands tied in Washington, and you're not able to do anything? Can't you do something locally that would send a message to the rest of the country?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think the country desperately would like to see a Republican and a Democrat from the same state working together. 4 days after the spill in the Animas River, I was in Telluride. I started this story because I thought I was in Aspen, but I don't think I was. I think I was in Telluride. And I called Corey up and I said, I'm going to go down there. Maybe you should come too. Instead of, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to show everybody I really care about them and you're going to be left on the Eastern Plains with nobody thinking. And he said, I appreciate the call, I'll come with you. We went down there. And the reason we were there the other day was to be there when the EPA guy came in, uncertain whether the promises he made are going to last. But we actually ended up doing one of these town halls. We stayed an hour later to do it. It was not planned, but it, I think, turned out to be something interesting. And we have not had much luck working on healthcare yet, just honestly. But we've had, we've gotten some public lands bills together, none of which are as big as I would like. There's some bigger things that I think we should be doing in a bipartisan way that I hope over time his staff will also, and he will also want to do. We have two bills that have to do with reforming Washington that are, one of which I had for years but never could find a Republican to join me. He now has signed on to that bill, and that is a bill that says if you've had the privilege of having been a member of the Senate or the member of the House, you should accept a lifetime ban on ever becoming a lobbyist in Washington, D.C.
Nice.
I really believe in that. People may think it's politics, but when half the people that retire or that leave Congress and don't retire end up being lobbyists in Washington, I believe that's one of the reasons the public looks at it and says, this is all kind of rigged. The second one we have is a bill that says that if the government were ever to shut down again, we were going to vote to shut the government down, that instead of going home, which is what we've done, all the senators have done over the past 7 or 8 years, you have to report to the floor of the Senate the next day at 8 o'clock, and you can't leave until the government is reopened. And that's the question. So there's some, you know, we're taking some steps together, but I quite agree with your point, which is, I think it's true on a lot of things, and sometimes to the frustration of people who feel like I'm not far enough over on one side. I really think part of, there's one there. I think part of the job, at the, see you, Jill, thanks for coming. Part of the job of somebody who has my job is to make principled compromises. I really believe that. I my friend Lamar Alexander, who's from Tennessee, who's a Republican, says, yeah, if you don't want to compromise, if you don't really want to legislate, you might as well just stay home and be on the radio. There's no reason for you to be in D.C., which is not to say that there aren't people in Washington who will never compromise with anybody or anybody in the other party. And the framers, again, were smart enough to devise a system where there were different roles for everybody to play. And I have just felt very strongly at this moment in the country's history, having more people willing to sit down, even if in the end you don't agree, with people from the other side is a virtue, not a vice. Would you do
this is the last one. If you didn't get to ask your question, you can grab a card from Senator Bennett's staff and they will respond to you. Julie and Noah and the whole crew, responsive.
And Julie, are you gonna connect with this gentleman? Okay.
Phil.
You're gonna pass?
Okay, great. So I wanna thank this group for being so incredibly civil and amazing doing this event. You've seen video of these kind of events throughout the country. They're not always civil. And when Senator Bennett said he was coming here, there was one criteria, and it was, I want anyone to be able to ask whatever they want. Maybe he thought this was a safe audience. He should have known better. This is Aspen. So he took a risk to be here. So thank you, Michael, for doing that.